In a lesson now for several weeks titled, What If Everything You Ever Want, Everything You Ever Wanted Isn't Enough? In it, we're unpacking and making a broad application of two ancient texts, one from the Hebrew Scriptures, one from the Christian Scriptures. From the Hebrew Scriptures, teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. The other from the Christian text is from Ephesians. In the first week, I did kind of a extended unpacking of that text, so let me just read to you some excerpts from the paraphrase that I did for that lesson. Don't waste your time. You don't get much of it. There are traps, easy to fall into. Don't fall in. It's easy to start down a good path, but get sucked into things we're ashamed of. Don't do that. Now, the purpose of this lesson, I've been saying, is to reflect on some big truth themes, the kinds of things that don't necessarily inform our day-to-day lives because we're in the midst of shopping for groceries and going to work and, you know, driving, doing what we do. But to take some moment to stand back and say, what are these big themes, in the hopes that as we are exploring them, an interior nudge bubbles up and says to us individually, here, now, small, doable. In other words, here is a small way that you can integrate this big theme into the day-to-day way that you live out your life. So if we can shape how we approach our dailiness, informed by these big themes, we find out that our lives have a better chance of being enough. It turns out that ancient wisdom and a tremendous amount of current research are all telling us that the four themes that I'll show you in a moment, these are critical to lives that are enough. So that was going on. After the first one, I paused for some parenthetical remarks in an inserted lesson that I hadn't planned for because we needed to process together some objections that came up. And the objections came up during the what are you thinking part. Now, by the way, I haven't said this in a long time, so let me say it again because I think you might not know. I started what are you thinking so that people could object. I started so that people could say, hey, I'm not buying that stuff. Because I know how my brain works, and I know a little bit about how our brains work, and it turns out that objecting is an essential component of learning. Now, you've heard me say it many times that the Christian church is in the throes of a great reformation right now. Actually, society is in the throes of a great renaissance right now. So we're mirroring what happened 500 years ago in our lifetimes. The last time that we, Christian folk, went through this magnitude of change was 500 years ago. Martin Luther, John Calvin, Zwingli, the split between the Catholic Church and the protesters, what we now call the Protestant Reformation. If you know about history, you know that that was a horrendously tumultuous time in human history, and so is right now. So our community has made the decision that we're going to throw in our lot with the future. We're going to do our part to be figuring out how it is that this reform is going to work itself out. So that has meant that a lot of the things that we're talking about are a little daunting because we are pushing toward change as opposed to resisting change. And that's the nature of tumultuous times like this. The minister has to stand up each week and say things that jangle us. And the reason is because change jangled us. Shifted metaphors jangle us. Differing perspectives jangle us. The kinds of things that happen during a moment of reform are jangling because change is jangling. And change is the nature of this historical moment. So when this much change is thrust on us this rapidly, at least people need to be able to say, yeah, but people need to be able to say, hey, hold on a minute. People need to be able to say, wait, what? And so we started, what are you thinking? Hey, hold on a minute. Wait, what? So I say that so that you don't feel bad when you sit there and think to yourself, I'm not sure I agree with that kinds of thoughts. And I don't want you to feel bad even when you say them out loud. That's actually why we started this. Because here's the reality, I might be wrong. We are trying to move forward into this moment in history, but it's not a surely laid out path. Now, I might be wrong, but the other possibility is that what I just said might need some context, that if we had that context, it would allow us to make this deep, demanding change that is set upon us by history. Anyway, I say all that to say, we did, what are you thinking? And people objected. Thank you. Good job. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. The objection went something like this. Nobody said it this baldly, but this is how I kind of synthesized it so I could do the follow-up lesson. It was, hey, Doug, if we take up those four themes, that is going to suck us dry. Restitching the torn fabric of community, contributing to something bigger than self, living in a meaning-making narrative, experiencing the divine. Sure, these are good themes, Doug. Thank you. Nice lesson. Well prepared. I appreciate you presenting it. But Doug, I don't think you get it. Because in our household, we're sending 80 to 100 hours out the door every week between the two of us. Not because we're greedy, not because we want to be rich, but simply that's what it takes to stay in the middle. That's the demands of our socio-economy right now. So, Doug, these are wonderful themes, but when, man, when are we supposed to integrate these things into our lives? Well, if you missed that parenthetical lesson, you can listen online, but you probably won't be surprised that what I did was to give some context from history. We spoke about the economic conditions in the 1970s, and we talked about Milton Friedman winning a Nobel Prize for solving a problem that was limiting economic growth. We talked about how the extraordinary success of that strategy has now led to a different set of problems, a new set of problems, one of which is the torn fabric of community, one of which is that we don't have the time, we don't have the bandwidth to be able to integrate these four themes, and I said that our society has swung like a pendulum over to this counterbalance when we were out of balance and we didn't go to balance, but we went. That we are here right now provides a bit of a pickle for us in our lives. Because even though our society has normalized a way of going to work, even though our society has normalized a way of being family, even though we have normalized a way of doing relationships, and those normalized ways are actually thwarting our ability to integrate these four themes into our lives, even though that's what we step into when we step out our front door every morning, that doesn't change the fact that we suffer when we don't integrate these four themes. So this moment in our historical lives, in our social economic lives, is pushing us, demanding us to become countercultural. We can't continue to live the way that our society lives because it is killing us. So, we suffer, even though our society has normalized this, even though this is what everybody does, even though this is the pressure to make sure we keep doing it this way, these four components are for the human soul. Seed and soil, light and water. That's what these things are. These are the essential ingredients hardwired into our human lives without which we do not thrive and we do not flourish. I'm listening to a book right now talking about the current research into SSRIs, you know, the serotonin something uptake inhibitors. I don't remember what the name is. But it turns out research is beginning to realize that what we thought in the 90s and in the early 2000s would be a magic bullet for anxiety and depression is not proving to be as effective over the long haul as we had hoped. Their efficacy for 20 weeks can fool us into thinking that they will have that kind of efficacy over a year or two or 20, but it turns out research is finding it, they don't last that long. And so this author's research began to unearth that the most effective treatment for anxiety and depression over the long haul turns out to be healing our social epidemic of disconnection, restitching the torn fabric of community, contributing to something bigger than self. These things actually serve to mitigate over the long haul what SSRIs are not proving able to do for the long term. Well, I dealt with depression for a decade, serious depression. 6 months in the middle of that, I was suicidal. And I'm listening to this book, and I want to just stand on the top of the house and shout to our community, to our society, people, the stuff we're working on is killing us. We are working on the stuff that is killing us all. This stuff really matters. We need to restitch the torn fabric of community. We need our civic organizations. We need our churches, our synagogues. We need our mosques to be places that begin to immunize us from this epidemic of disconnection. Places that are working on this stuff, these four themes, are working on the stuff that's depressing us, working on the stuff that's alienating us, working on the stuff that is making us anxious, working on the stuff that is killing us. And that is the role of spiritual communities. And it is a role to which we must return to work together on integrating these big life themes into the dailiness of our time on this earth. So anyway, that's the parenthetical remarks that I made last week. If you missed online, you can listen online. There'll be a little bit of history there, some economics, some brain science. And then last week, we began looking at the second of these four, contributing to something bigger than self. And I said that as we are thinking about this great theme, this big one, we have to consider two components. What does it mean to contribute to something bigger than self? Well, the first thing we said last week is we have to arrange our lives if we're going to contribute to something bigger than self. We arrange our lives around those things that will leave the world better than we found it. To arrange our lives around things that will leave the world better than we found it. The second component I said last week is that we arrange our lives around things that will remain after we have finished our time on the planet. We arrange our lives around things that leave the earth better than we found it, and we arrange our lives around the things that will remain after we have finished our few years on the planet. I was very close to a seminary professor that I had along the way. He and his wife kind of took a grand parental role in my life for about 10 years. And so I was in their home a lot, and in their kitchen, they had a cross-stitched framed picture. I guess cross-stitching was a thing in their generation. And this is what it said. It said, "Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for God will last. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for God will last." Now, we worked really hard in our community, reframing our metaphors for God and reframing our metaphors for the spiritual journey. So I might have reworded that cross-stitched saying now, but the sentiment, the thought, was formative for me. It got deeply embedded in my soul. Only one life, it goes by so fast. Young person, you need to pay attention to this. It is fast. Because until you reach the middle of your life, it will seem that your future will extend for forever, but that's only because of percentages. Early in your life, you will only have spent 10% or 20% or 30% of your life. And so the balance that's remaining will just seem like it lasts forever. But as soon as you hit 50% or 60% of your life lived, all of a sudden you realize how quickly this thing goes. And so, young person, heed the text in Ephesians. Don't waste your time. Don't fall into the traps. Spend your precious few moments on this earth serving something bigger than self, serving God by serving your neighbor, serving God by serving others, serving God by leaving the earth better than you found it. Do that, countless generations testify. Do that, and your life will be enough. Leave the world better than you found it. Maybe that means serving a big, important cause in a way that is here now, small, doable. Maybe it means listening for the interior voice to talk to you, have you about how you might engage in human rights or the achievement gap or racial equity. How can I participate, your prayer might go, in the three levels of restorative justice, restoring the harm done to the individual, restoring harm done to the relationship, restoring harm done to the community. That's what we're working on when we're working on the victim assistance network. We're working on harm done to the individual. That's what we're working on when we're working with Wake County Schools, harm that has been done to a relationship. That's what we're working on when we're getting involved in this community of communities, harm that's been done to the community. We ask the interior voice, is there a small part for me in this big, important cause? Is there a way here, in this place, in this role, that I can leave the earth better than I found it? Is there a way that I can add my effort to this collective effort to leave the world better than we found it? Or it might mean contributing to something bigger than self. It might mean small ways that could be just as potent in the way that we approach the little things in life. I was reading about mental health in teenagers recently, and it turns out that when a family depends upon a teenager, maybe for cleaning or cooking or childcare, those teens have a greater sense of purpose in their lives. And that translates into a deeper engagement in life in general. By contributing to the family's well-being, by contributing to something bigger than self, teens tap into that environment for which we were all created. The environment in which we thrive. They live lives giving themselves to something bigger than self. And when they do, life becomes for them more meaningful. They become more resilient. They are more motivated when life throws challenges their way. And they have the tenacity that is needed to muddle through the problematic tough times in life. They're less likely to drift aimlessly. They end up getting better grades. They become less likely to engage in risky behaviors like drugs or drug addiction. It's just a component of human nature. Contributing to something bigger than self is an essential for lives that in the end are enough. When we contribute to something bigger than self, it also evokes self-reflection, self-awareness. One of the key ways that we discern what our strengths are, what our talents are, what our insights and what our capacities are, is to contribute. And when we do, we see those things we are gifted at, we see what we're good at, we discern what we have to contribute, and there comes this deep embedded assurance that these onboard abilities that we come into the world carrying, they are something we have to offer. And so we realize we have a gift to give. We have a gift to give in the arena that is bigger than self. Again, it's just a component of human nature. It's how we evolved to be. We lived in tribes and bands of 30 or 40 people for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and we've learned, adapted to, had brains wired for functioning in that interdependent context. We need to be contributors to something bigger than self. One of the other things that contributing does is it helps us identify our core beliefs. When we give ourselves in service to something bigger than self, we begin to discern what matters in the world, what is helpful in the world, what is bringing about restoration to the world around us. And in the process of doing that, we say, ah, that's important, ah, that's not. We begin to have this discerning grid set before us. And that, in turn, helps us shape lifetime objectives. As opposed to living for these short moments, we begin to think in longer terms because these bedrock values of what's important have been demonstrated in an experiential way in our lives. When we see a role that we have to play in this bigger context, we see how we are able to help others. We tend to trial and error our way into discerning this point of identity. This is why I'm on the earth. This is what I have to give. Now, what that tends to do is stretch us to aspire even further. We not only want to fulfill the kind of people we are, the gifting that we have, but we also begin to want to aspire. I want to become this kind of person. And that begins to give us lifetime aspirations and lifetime goals, becoming goals, contributing to something bigger than self. It helps us discern a deep part of what we have to give on this planet. When we do that, we come to know ourselves in this interconnected web of oneness that we talked about this morning. The sense that we are in relationship to others. We are not, as our nation's ethos would tell us, we are not rugged individuals. We are an interconnected web of belonging. And we realize that in that context, I have a gift to give, I have a strength to offer, and what I have to offer really is valuable to the world around me. Well, that whole process of engaging and contributing to something bigger than self shapes us. It helps us move forward. It helps us discern what context we would be best suited to. What kind of work context would be best for me? What kind of social context can I have something to offer? What kind of civic context? Where do I go so that I can give this gift that I have to give? And that helps us know when we should say yes. And that helps us know when we should say no. And we begin to say those yeses and say those noes in ways that begin to shape the way that our daily lives are lived. And our lives become shaped around a construct that is bigger than self. Organizing our days this way, contributing to the world being a better place than we found it. We know ourselves better. We become stronger. It makes us hardy, flexible, sturdy. Contributing situates our daily lives in service to something bigger than self. It helps us discern deeper ways to be ourselves. It helps us give our gifts. It helps us better the world. So this week, I don't know if you have, but I've been watching snippets of graduation speeches, commencement speeches, and there have been lots of people saying lots of things. But one of the recurring themes that comes up on a regular basis is strive to do what you love. Strive to do what you love. Well, this guy, this is Immanuel Kant. He'd be sitting at those speeches saying, yeah, I don't think so. He'd be saying, I don't think that's going to work for you. I think if you strive to do what you love, you're not necessarily going to get the life that you want. He would say, you probably won't get that life. You would actually do better if you would strive to do your duty. Who's going to buy that? Not many people. That's an ugly word. I'm not going to do duty. What are you talking about? Obligation. And then he would go on to define duty, and he'd say, this is what duty means. Do the thing that you're good at that will make the world a better place. And he'd go on to say, if you're going to chase happy, there's a good chance you're going to miss it. But if you chase finding out what you're good at and giving that away in service to other people, then there's a pretty good chance you're going to find a noble life. And what a noble life will do is increase the odds that you're going to be happy. Now, I really don't know how to pronounce this guy's name anymore. I thought it was Buckner, and then I heard Buechner. And so whatever this guy's name is, let's call him Fred. Fred said something similar. He said, a meaningful life, we would say the life that is enough, a meaningful life is experienced at the intersection of your own deep gladness and the world's deep hunger. I so much appreciated that. The intersection of your own deep gladness and the world's deep hunger. It turns out that people who rank their jobs as deeply fulfilling usually see their jobs as a way to help others. That's how you find a fulfilling job. Is your job helping others? And these people who find the most fulfillment in their work tend to say that if their jobs were to go away, the world would be worse off. So that applies to high-level work. It applies to menial work. So this book kind of speaks to this topic we're discussing today. Power of Meaning, the author's name is Emily Smith. She said this, women working in a factory doing repetitive work, boring work, work they're not thrilled about. If they see what they are doing as helping others, usually supporting their families, they tend to be more productive. They work longer hours, they work more productively during those hours, and they work for more years working those hours. They tend to make fun on their jobs, they tend to make friends on their jobs, and they tend to make even menial work interesting. Those who did not see their jobs as contributing to someone else didn't. If what we do benefits others, If what we do benefits those we love, it shapes us. It shapes our lives. In that same book, there was a story about a janitor who worked at NASA during the moonshot years, and I guess JFK came to visit after that speech, in 10 years we'll do this thing. And he asked the janitor what he was doing, and he said, "I'm helping putting a man on the moon." The author told another story of a road worker in Colorado who stood periodically turning a sign. He would turn it, it would say slow, he would turn it and say stop. He would turn it and say slow, turn it and say stop. When he was asked how he kept from being bored, he said, "Bored? I'm keeping people safe. I really care about those guys that are down and those guys behind me. And this is how I keep them safe." When I first moved to Raleigh, First of all, I could not believe there was such a beautiful place in the world. I grew up in a little beach town in North San Diego, so you would think I know about beautiful places. But I realized after I had been in Raleigh for 10 minutes that I had never all my life felt at home. Because when I was in Raleigh for 10 minutes, I knew what it meant to be to feel like you were at home. And so I really ought to be on the Chamber of Commerce, I can tell you. And so I would just drive around in just this state of amazement that such a beautiful place. I mean, here's the thing. Do you know that there are places that don't have green bands between the road and a subdivision? There are places that don't do that. You can drive through Raleigh and think you're in the forest. And lo and behold, there's 1,000 homes right behind that forest. And it's just the way that it's been planned is lovely. I love this place. Non-density, that was a novelty for me. But in my drives around town, I would see homes that had big wheels out in front in the driveway, that had basketball hoops out in front in the highway, in their driveways. And it was a recurring experience for me during those years to have this surge of irrational love for the people who lived in those homes. Now, I didn't know those people. I was new to town, but I knew enough about society to know what was going on in their homes. I've been a student of what goes on in Raleigh and what goes on in Los Angeles and what goes on in Phoenix and what goes on in Cincinnati and what goes on in Hartford, Connecticut, what goes on in Seattle. I know what goes on in those homes behind those doors. And I had a recurring sense of love because I know that behind those doors there is an epidemic of disconnection. That is what's happening. And I also knew that the church had lost its way. Churches were not creating the spaces for thriving health growth. And I knew that there were not any other civic organizations that had stepped in to replace the church and fill the void. And I knew that these beautiful homes were in a slow-moving crisis, an epidemic of disconnection. And I knew that despite the church's current illness, we had something to offer to this epidemic. I didn't know at the time what the toxin was that had infected us. I did not know what the illness was that had overtaken us. I have a much better idea now. But I knew that we had a rich legacy of being able to offer health and well-being to souls. And even though this was a time, and it still is, when we, the American Christians, have kind of lost our way, and even though I couldn't pin down what the problem was, I knew about our heritage. When we are at our best, when we find our way, ours is a legacy of deep transformation and health. Now, I grew up in this social illness, as did you, but I've also seen enough glimpses of vitality and life in the churches, almost holdovers from a previous time when we were not as ill as we have become. And I've read enough history to know that there is a spiritual pathway to wholeness and to health. And so I carried around this internal sense that we can do something about the stuff that's killing us all. We can leave the world better than we found it. We can leave a legacy of wholeness after we're gone, and it can affect those homes with basketball hoops and with big wheels in the front yard. And that internal sense profoundly shaped me then, and it is a shaping that I still carry with me. And that shaping has informed my day-to-day activities. It has given me a decision matrix. It helps me discern when I should say yes and when I should say no. It has helped me to learn what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, because every day I get up and I'm moving in that direction that is bigger than self, contributing to something bigger than who I am or what I want. And that has helped me find a place of contribution. It has helped me to know myself in this interconnected web of relationship that happens. And you would think that that's some kind of rarefied experience for preacher folks, but it isn't. It's the life that has been set before all of us. It's the life of human thriving. And it's a life that in the end is enough. What has been true for me is true for all of us. A life that is enough is a life that is spent leaving the world better than we found it. A life that is enough is a life that is spent doing things that will remain after we are gone. The alternative is to fall prey to the epidemic that has infected our society in our time. Division, being disheartened, being cast down, being emptied, depressed, anxious, suffering the epidemic of disconnection. A life that is enough is not found when the individual pursues life, liberty, and happiness. The life that is enough is not found when the individual avoids pain and pursues pleasure. That just simply is not enough. An important component of a life that is enough, one of our four, is to have spent our lives making the world better than we found it. To have spent our lives contributing to something bigger than self. To have spent our lives working on the stuff that is killing us all. And that's my prayer for us as individuals and collectively as a community. So, Holy Spirit of God within us, may it be that we find our way into lives that are enough, that we would find our own niche where we can give ourselves in service to something bigger than self. May that be as we follow Jesus. Amen.